Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of February, all things political this hour with you. I have Jenny Fehman, a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. Has the Affordable Care Act achieved its goals or fallen short? And what's the Supreme Court likely to say about subsidies? Right to Work is on the fast track in Wisconsin. In all likelihood, it will become the country's 25th Right to Work state. The Obama administration's plan to keep more than 4 million immigrants living in the country illegally from deportation is on hold. And it's tied to Homeland Security. Many Republicans opposing funding Homeland Security, and that money's going to run out in just a few days if there isn't an overturn of the president's executive action on immigration. Is Hillary Clinton inevitable? Is Jeb Bush inevitable? Governor Scott Walker criticizing the question, but his answer is receiving criticism as well when asked about whether or not the president is a Christian. Walker says such questions from reporters are reflective of a broader problem in the nation's media culture, fixated on issues that are not relevant to most Americans, but in the national spotlight, he's going to get many such questions. What do you think of the response? Is too much being made of it? We'll be welcoming phone calls. We always do. And here is how you reach us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter. And that's at K Dunn Show. Yevgeny Fehman is fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. And he writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, the Affordable Care Act. His research focuses on a number of areas: the physician shortage, the cost of healthcare reform, and consumer directed healthcare. And he's written for many publications: the National Review, Fox News, the Washington Examiner, Health Affairs, and Political, and has been on our show several times before. So please join our conversation. There is a lot to talk about this hour. Yevgeny, thank you very much for being with us. Happy Monday.
Thank you for having me. Happy Monday to you, too.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's start with healthcare. That's your specialty. And there are different reports about this. The New York Times had an interesting piece yesterday saying that this Affordable Care Act is really doing superbly well. It's achieved nearly all of its ambitious goals. A Wall Street executive, Stephen Ratner, writes that the three key provisions have been performing very, very well. I would imagine that you have a different view. How well is it performing?
Well, I think if you go by HHS's goal for enrollment this year, it's definitely doing pretty well. They set a low bar, about 9 million to about 10 million. And in total enrollments that they've seen for this year, that's reached up to 11.5 million, roughly, on the exchanges. You factor in the states that have expanded Medicaid, and I think for the administration's goals, for Democrats' goals in Congress, that's definitely a boon. Now, whether that represents all of the goals of the ACA, I'm not so sure. I think part of the goal was also to make healthcare more affordable. I don't think that's happened, and I think that's a big part that a lot of people are missing. You know, you focus only on coverage gains. A lot of this coverage is coming with very high deductible plans. You've had a slowdown in healthcare spending, but prices are still up, especially for drugs, for inpatient physician services. So people are still facing a lot of healthcare costs that this law hasn't really tackled.
Do we need another law to look at those very issues?
Well, I think it all could have been handled properly had the law actually had the bill before it passed gone to conference. There's a lot more that can be done. It could be in another law. It could be amendments to the ACA. But we certainly haven't gone far enough on some elements, and in others, I think we've gone a little bit too far in making insurance more expensive than it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, what is the likelihood that this whole program could essentially be halted with a Supreme Court decision on subsidies?
You know, it's hard to gauge where the Supreme Court will fall there. I mean, it's 50-50 in my mind. I think it's realistic because at least four judges on the Supreme Court believe that the petitioner's arguments have some merit. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been given a writ of cert, and that's a powerful signal. On the other hand, you have some standing issues that are coming to light right now. I don't think those are going to derail the case, but it's certainly a little bit problematic if you think that these plaintiffs who the petitioners found are the best plaintiffs that they could have found.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of interpretation, I think there are reasonable arguments on either side. The petitioners certainly have a point regarding the letter of the law. The administration has a point in regards to the spirit of the law, intent, and other parts of the law that are meant to be read in context. So as a matter of which way the Supreme Court will go, really either way could be a realistic ruling. But I think Republicans have come to a consensus, and rightfully so, that if for the Supreme Court to feel confident in striking down the subsidies, they need to have some kind of alternative ready to go. And I think that's what they've been focusing on right now. That's why they have this new reform plan that they released a few weeks ago, ready to go.
Mm-hmm. It would be very hard if you didn't have something else in place, because already this Affordable Care Act has affected a lot of Americans. A lot of people are signed up for it and are living with some of the provisions that many people find beneficial.
Exactly, and the people that would get hit the hardest, ironically, would be in Republican states, because you're talking about taking away subsidies from the states that are running federal exchanges, the ones that didn't set up their own exchanges. Those tend to be red states that refuse to set up exchanges. So it could become a political problem for Republicans not to have some alternative ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to immigration. The Department of Homeland Security very shortly about to lose its funding tied to whether or not there will be an overturn of the president's executive action on immigration. And his decision is on hold now with that federal judge ruling a couple days ago. What's going to happen? Homeland Security defunded by Friday. That could be serious, couldn't it?
It would be very serious, and I think a stopgap funding measure is in the cards. I don't think Republicans are going to allow DHS to actually lose its funding. They just don't win these kind of fights, and I hope that they've learned that by now. You need to get a stopgap funding measure into the bill, and honestly, I think you fund DHS on its own, pull out any kind of additional riders, and deal with those separately. I think in general, when you're talking about funding the government, there's no reason to start throwing in particular riders and demands from the other side as if to hold them hostage. That's not what you want out of a government. You want a government that can keep running while you hash out political differences separately.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the president's executive action was unconstitutional?
You know, it's hard to say. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I think it definitely broached the limit of where constitutional executive authority can reach. As a policy matter, I think it's actually a good thing. I'm in favor of open borders. I'm in favor of full legalization. So as far as I'm concerned, anything that moves us closer to that is a good thing. But I also think it was very politically motivated. It was designed as a way of taking away immigration from Republicans, because he knew Republicans couldn't support that as an actual political measure, even though Jeb Bush, for instance, might support it as a policy measure. So, obviously one court thinks that there was a problem with it, there was a constitutional problem with it. We'll see how that plays out.
Yevgeny, why is it such a political issue?
A lot of it has to do with constituencies, I think. People have a lot of misconceptions about who illegal immigrants are. Some people living in the South tend to think that it's primarily people who cross the border illegally. In reality, a very, very large share of people who are here illegally have overstayed visas. So they came in legally, but they just overstayed. Sealing up the border, for instance, is a common refrain among more hawkish Republicans, and it comes from this misconception, this misunderstanding of what's actually happening on the ground. I think the fact that we've had a weak economy also serves to bolster some of those opinions. You look around, you see that there are no jobs available. You look for something to blame, and immigrants are very easy scapegoats. You can say, you know, these immigrants that don't have to abide by minimum wage laws are taking our jobs. And that's a powerful rallying call.
Let's move to presidential politics, although I do so somewhat reluctantly because the darned election is still almost 2 years away, but here we are. Frank Bruni had an interesting column yesterday, and the question has been asked, both of these stories were in the Times yesterday, is Hillary Clinton inevitable? The author of that piece believes that, yes, she is inevitable. Bruni's column looked at Jeb Bush, who may also be inevitable for 2016 candidates, and I'm interested in your response to this. He says Jeb Bush is no more his own man than Hillary Clinton is her own woman. And in her case, too, I'm not talking about the imprint of her family. I'm talking about financial ties, past, present, and future. I'm talking about the reality growing ever more pronounced and ominous that you can't run for a major, fiercely contested political office in this country without becoming a monstrous, ceaseless, insatiable hoover of money.
I think there's a lot that's made about financial ties and political donations, but what we've seen from lots and lots of research, especially into presidential elections, is that one of the biggest deciding factors tends to be the economy, the performance of the economy alone. Tends to affect lots of results. Now, here you're not going to have an incumbent, so. Money's going to be important, but we have to be very, very careful about turning something that's a perception of the conflict of interest into an actual conflict. Both sides get contributions from Wall Street, for instance.
Right.
We've got a Dodd-Frank bill that at least many on the right have criticized for. Over-regulating. And, maybe there's some argument to be made that big guys like Goldman Sachs actually like that. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a lot of people in the finance community that really, really like the Dodd-Frank bill. So there might be some perceptions of a conflict of interest going on. But I don't think money is a deciding factor at all in our elections.
You don't think it is at all, really?
It certainly plays a role. You need a minimum amount of money to run, but I think we're seeing more and more that you're getting funding from Wall Street, let's say, on both sides. So it's hard for that to really affect one side or the other. You know, they want to make sure that they do have an ear at the administration, but I think that's about all it does. I don't think it's the deciding factor.
Mm-hmm. He went on to talk about the Clinton Foundation and it receiving a lot of money from foreign countries who can't give, to regular political
sure.
campaigns, but they can give to the foundation. And you have to ask, don't they believe that they'll have a seat on the table if she should become president? Because they gave a lot of money.
Well, I wonder what that really means. You know, the Clinton Foundation does a lot of amazing charity work. So, insofar as other countries are giving money to the Clinton Foundation, I think that's great. That means other countries are interested in the charity work that the Clinton Foundation is doing. I think that's distinct from Hillary's campaign. There's this indirect connection that we see, but I certainly don't think that if Hillary were to become president, she'd sell out American interests for foreign interests. I can't see that happening.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a moment because we are in Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker is getting a lot of national news in the last few days, particularly for a couple comments, one saying he doesn't know whether President Obama is a Christian. I don't know, he said when he was asked at the winter meeting of the National Governors Association. I've actually never talked about it or I haven't read about that. I've never asked him that. You've asked me to make statements about people that I haven't had a conversation with. How could I say if I know either one of you are Christians? Somebody from his office called later and said that this was, and then he later said that it was a classic example of why people hate Washington. His spokesperson telephoned the Washington Post to say the governor was trying to make a point of principle by not answering such kinds of questions, he wasn't trying to cast doubt on Obama's faith. A couple questions here about him, why he's been rising so steadily to the top of the early favorites for the Republican nomination. And two, he hasn't had a lot of exposure to the national stage. He is likely to get questions like that from all kinds of people. When you think about what John McCain was asked when he was running for president, the president's an Arab, and how he responded to that. What do you think of this response? And do you agree that his answer, that the press is fixated on issues that aren't relevant, will serve him well?
Well, I think Scott Walker, the candidate, still has a lot to learn. And I don't like the fact that we ask our candidates questions like this. I mean, they're fundamentally unrelated to the job of being president. And, you know, it's really the same thing as when we were asking President Obama to provide proof of his citizenship with a birth certificate. We've never asked any other president in history to do that. So these aren't questions I like. I don't think it's good that we have this kind of climate, but it's something that candidates have to deal with. Candidate Obama also took a little while to really get going to learn how to deal with the media, and he did. I think it's going to be the same thing with Candidate Walker. He's going to take a little while to get used to these kind of questions and figure out the right way to answer them. And you know, that's just the game. That's how it's going to be played.
And it's very early, as we mentioned earlier, but why do you think he's so close to the top in some of these early polls in Iowa and New Hampshire?
I think one of the reasons is he's really he was one of the first supporters of not necessarily right to work, but one of the first governors to push back against public sector unions, and I think that's becoming a more and more important issue for the 2016 election. So that alone gives him some serious national prominence. It gives him a powerful spotlight, a powerful podium. And he's ever since his battle with public sector unions, he's remained at the national level. He's been very, very visible. Other candidates maybe are considered a little bit less conservative, maybe not real Republicans. They're looked at as, quote-unquote, rhinos, Republicans in name only. Jeb Bush, maybe, Chris Christie. So, as far as straw polls go or his perception among the Republican establishment, it makes sense to me why he's near the top of the list, even ahead of some people like Bush and Christie.
Yeah, Jenny Faiman is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute, and we're covering a variety of issues this hour. Feel free to join in. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We started with the Affordable Care Act. Do you think it's doing very well, as the president says, and as some have been saying? It's more people are signed up and many more people are positively affected? Or do you also share Yevgeny's concerns that it hasn't really brought down the cost of health care in this country significantly, which is a huge issue still for a lot of people? Oh, and I have yet to ask him about Elizabeth Warren, who's decided she will take on the pharmaceutical industry as her next project. What does he think of that? The Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, being tied to executive action on immigration. What do you make of that? What do you think of Governor Scott Walker's comments concerning whether or not the president loves the country, and also whether or not President Obama is a Christian? Is that just a gotcha kind of journalism, or does it say something about him when you hear answers? We have yet to talk about right to work in the state of Wisconsin, which seems quite inevitable. And we'll be taking your phone calls with all of your thoughts on all of this in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls for All Things Political, and we start today with Ed in West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Well, Kathleen, today it's Ed coming to you from the state capitol in Madison, and I don't think that right to work is inevitable, but I do want to talk about the only candidate that organized labor can support in 2016, and that's Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. We have seen Ms. Clinton and Mr. Clinton just fall down on right-to-work legislation in 1993. He promised us that right-to-work would be repealed from the National Labor Relations Act, and he never really owned up to his promise. Mr. Obama, the same way with the Employee Free Choice Act. And the only alternative that we have going into 2016 is a draft Elizabeth Warren movement. And I think you're going to see in the next 5 to 6 months this movement just pick up more steam. And I think that she's going to be the Democratic nominee come the summer of 2016. Mm.
And Ed, when you think that right to work will not pass in Wisconsin?
We have to flip one vote today, Kathleen. Jerry Petrowski's in the definite no column. So we are right now, we have to flip one vote. Luther Olson or Van Weingard or maybe Ms. Vukmir. These are people that organized labor are focusing on today. If you believe in life, if you believe in the quality of life, then you cannot believe in right to work. And these people who are so anti-abortion are going to have an opportunity to vote for life on Wednesday. And that means a secure wage and union security and safety for all workers in the state of Wisconsin.
Thanks, Ed, very much for your call. He brings up a couple areas. Let's start with right to work. That's what brings him to Madison. Do you think? Would you agree with him that it may not be inevitable in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's going to be probably inevitable nationally. Whether or not Wisconsin can pass legislation in the last last Supreme Court cases. We saw that, at the very least, Justice Alito indicated that the old Abood precedent, as it's called, which effectively protected the closed shop union, he questioned that precedent. Mm-hmm. And right now, we're likely to see a case come from Illinois with Governor Rauner taking on public sector unions. And if that makes it to the Supreme Court, I think it's very, very likely that we could see Abood overturned. And if that happens, then closed shops basically become illegal, which would effectively create right to work nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a bigger national movement at play, whether or not it happens in Wisconsin before that or not, may not be relevant 5 or 10 years down the line.
What do you make of his comments concerning Elizabeth Warren? I wonder if she'll run as well. She keeps saying, I'm not running, and then she's all over the place again, and there's more speculation that maybe she is running. Would she have a chance? I don't know if she'd have much of a chance against Hillary Clinton, but do you think that she will run, and might she have a chance or not?
Well, I think she might try to get the nomination. I don't know if she'll have much of a shot, like you said. She'll appeal to those furthest on the left wing, the really strong, hardcore progressives. But you know, I'm not sure how much of the base that really is. In my view, I think there are much more moderated Democrats out there who may not see public sector unions as quite as in such a good light as Elizabeth Warren does. There's always the option for her to run as a third party candidate, but I'm not sure if she'll do that, mainly out of party loyalty, because that would hurt whatever Democrat candidate is running in the election, and it could become a kind of Ross Perot moment.
Mm-hmm. I meant to ask you about this. She has stated that the next area that she will examine pretty fully, and she does her work, is the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, she's proposing this idea of a pharmaceutical swear jar, so to speak, to have companies pay extra whenever they settle criminal charges with the federal government and have that money used to fund the NIH. I think funding the NIH is a great idea. We should be funding much more of the NIH. I think this is the wrong way to do it, simply because we have so many onerous regulations on pharmaceutical companies. What really qualifies as criminal charges often is very innocuous. Let's say a drug company discovers new problems with some of its drugs or with one of its drugs that they want to communicate directly to physicians. They're not allowed to do that. And if they do, they face criminal charges, and then they have to settle those charges with the federal government. We've created a system where it costs pharmaceutical companies money if they want to communicate newfound safety information, and that's just wrong. If we want to punish pharmaceutical companies that legitimately do something wrong, that are guilty of neglect, that's great, and using those proceeds to fund the NIH is a terrific idea. We should just be focusing on why we have so many settlements and whether all the settlements really are necessarily criminal in nature or whether it's a problem with the regulations. Mm.
What about, Yevgeny, though, the focusing on the amount of money that these drugs cost here in the United States when it's not nearly as much elsewhere? Isn't that a reason for examination?
Sure. There's a lot of things we should be looking at, and the cost of drugs is a problem, especially as we're going to see more and more people with high-deductible health plans that are exposed to more of the full cost of these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But why they're so expensive? Again, part of it comes down to regulations. Developing a drug is extremely expensive. It costs well over $1 billion to get a drug approved and then taken to market. Failure rates are extremely high. We have drugs that, because of one adverse effect, we put on the shelf. Take the story of thalidomide, for instance. It caused horrible birth deformations in the 60s, I believe. And more recently, it was redeveloped by Celgene as a cancer drug, simply with a note that pregnant women shouldn't use it. And it's helped thousands of people now. So we make it very difficult for a lot of drugs to get approved. When you make that process expensive, you have fewer companies that are able to compete. That drives up the price. In terms of whether we should be using price controls, maybe that's a discussion that should happen. But before we have that discussion, I think, again, focus on the regulatory barriers, focus on what's wrong with the regulatory environment we've created, fix that, and then see what happens. If then we're still paying what we consider an outsized sum, then we can start talking about other things.
Yeah. Well, I just want to know why there are so many darn commercials for Viagra. No, seriously, I do. I don't quite understand it.
Well, look, people want to buy it. It's a lifestyle drug. Viagra is a relatively cheap drug now, too. Actually, it's interesting. The story of Viagra was originally developed as a blood pressure medication.
Was it really?
It was. And they saw some positive side effects.
I guess so, yeah. Ed, thanks for your on-the-scene reporting in Madison, or for calling in while you are there. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Let's go to, so we got a lot of mail coming in, too. Dave sends this email. The way Governor Walker replied to the "Is the President a Christian?" question reminds me kind of Hillary Clinton's 2008 reply when asked on the campaign trail, "Is Barack Obama a Muslim?" She replied, "Not that I know of," instead of just saying no. So this is the same type of reply. It also shows how the media is not interested in policy, but more about creating conflict. Your guest's comments.
I totally agree. As I said before, this is just the game that candidates have to learn to play, and it's not good. I mean, I don't think it helps anyone. It riles people up. It stirs up controversy and conflict. It makes people feel like these innocuous comments really matter, that they signify what a candidate actually believes. They don't. But this definitely serves to get more people clicking on link bait. When BuzzFeed has a listicle, 10 gaffes by Scott Walker or Hillary Clinton or George Bush, Jeb Bush, whoever, they get more traffic like that. That's the people that this kind of reporting serves.
Well, part of the problem, though, is, I mean, the whole thing was started, wasn't it, with Mayor Giuliani, who was talking about how the president doesn't love the country. I mean, what in the world is he doing saying that? And then if you're in the audience listening to what he says and you're a presidential candidate, you can see the press saying, well, what do you think about what Giuliani just said, this incredible comment? So that's what got the ball rolling. If you say those kinds of things, you're going to ask for people in your party to get a response to it.
Absolutely, and any candidate, any political figure that goes and proactively makes those kinds of comments, that's terrible. As a political figure, you have to watch what you say, especially when you're saying it of your own initiative.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit different when someone comes to Scott Walker and asks, "Do you believe in evolution?" You know, rather than Scott Walker going and starting a conversation about evolution, saying, "Well, I don't believe in evolution," or "I do, but." XYZ.
Mm-hmm. David is next in Madison. Hi, David.
Hello. I'm calling because I have talked to my son who has some concerns about the Affordable Care Act. He's a physician and he would like to see it eliminated. And he'd also like to, he also said he'd like to see insurance companies eliminated and just have the market decide what the cost of medicine is. I don't think that's going to work either. But what I would like to know is what is a simple explanation, if there is one, that would explain what the Republicans want if ACA is away with.
Okay, it's a legitimate question. What do they want?
Well, very, very little when it comes to healthcare is simple. Republicans that want the ACA completely repealed. I'm not sure what they want. I'll be honest. I'm not in that camp. And I think pure repeal with nothing else, the return to the status quo, is unrealistic. And frankly, it's bad. The status quo before was a terrible situation. That being said, the Republicans that criticize the ACA and offer up replacements, what they want to see is a market that's less distorted by harmful regulations, that's less distorted by tax benefits that favor the upper middle class and the rich much more than those who really need it. And that's visible in their proposals. The Coburn-Burr Hatch bill, which is now the Upton-Burr Hatch bill, resurrected from last year. One of the things it would do is basically move forward with its own version of the ACA's Cadillac tax, move it up a year, and it would take away some of those benefits that go to higher income people. It would also give more choice to people who become eligible for Medicaid, still offering them subsidies to buy private insurance. The ACA, overall the structure isn't bad. I don't think that. Honestly speaking, many Republicans have a problem with that structure, but the details do matter a lot. And there you get into a lot of the weeds, and I'm not sure we necessarily have time for all of that.
Thanks so much, David, for your call. You do wish, and maybe this is just wishing for something that will never take place, but you do wish that on this issue that has been deemed so important for so many years in this country, health care, and making it more affordable for people and accessible to people, that you could have had people get together, as they did before it became political, to sit down and agree on what can we do to give more people insurance and to bring down the cost of health care. Most everybody would say that's a worthy goal. And look what's happened to it. It's gone on with this bitter debate for years.
It has. And, it has to do with the way that we've managed healthcare for 50 or 60 years. It hasn't been individuals in charge of their healthcare. We've delegated that mostly to employers. And we've given them tax benefits to do that. So I think you had enough people kind of on the inside circle, people who either have Medicare or have private insurance through their employers that were happy enough with the status quo. Most people never face catastrophic health care costs. So for all those years, they were fine with this. Someone else took care of it. They paid maybe a $50 copay when they went to see their physician. It's only now, partly because of the passage of the ACA, that people are finally starting to pay attention to this, and now we're having that conversation that we should have had 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. We have phone lines open if you want to join our all things political conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Yevgeny Feyman is our guest. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. And we have talked about a number of issues, the Affordable Care Act. We've been looking at immigration and the Department of Homeland Security. Governor Scott Walker's comments, you don't want to single him out, but he is governor of this state and he would appear to be running for president. So we're talking about some of his comments that have been under scrutiny. Do you think it's inevitable? I think this is an interesting question. Maybe you don't, but is it inevitable that Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton will be the nominees for the 2016 presidential election? Is it? And isn't there something weird about that, that people with the same names who've already had family members in office for a long period of time, that they would become inevitable? Wouldn't you want some fresh blood, be you on the Democratic side or the Republican side? Well, those are just a few things. Right to work in the state of Wisconsin, perhaps it's not inevitable. And some of the other issues we've talked about, or maybe there are some that we haven't and you'd like to have discussed. Here is our phone number. Give us a ring. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. You are listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls for Yevgeny Feyman and to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Just as a quick aside, I just say that anybody that thinks that Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush have any credibility ought to Google under drugs, MENA, M-E-N-A, Arkansas, and Barry Seals and see what you get. See if you think either one of these people are respectable. The main thing I want to talk today about, though, is sovereignty. Because, you know, a lot of stuff is brought up in terms of immigration about sovereignty. But we're having our sovereignty violated as we speak right now. We have a process going on in Nebraska where a Canadian company, because the Canadians don't want to have a pipeline go into their West Coast, is suing for eminent domain so that they can send pipelines across key water aquifers in Nebraska and send it down to the coast for refining. And when these pipes break, of course, the fracking materials could poison the water supply and cause tremendous environmental problems. And then when it gets to the coast, of course, it would be to the southern coast, it would get to the point of being refined in refineries that will be located no likely near poor people who also could be affected by the environment. And then we can take this stuff and not use any of it for United States consumption and send it out to countries like China and extract the profit out of it, all at the risk of the American people.
Yevgeny, what do you think of the Keystone?
The interesting thing about Keystone, I think, for now at least, its profitability has become questionable because we've seen oil and natural gas prices just plummet. I'm not sure about the specifics about where, at which price ranges Keystone is and isn't profitable. But you know, I've heard this idea that because we're shipping out natural gas, because we want to export natural gas, it's not helping the American people. You know, that leads you to a very, very odd position, which would say that we shouldn't export anything. We should keep everything here, that the manufacturers who use natural gas to produce goods that get exported should just keep the goods here. Exports are a good thing. Imports are also a good thing. There's nothing inherently bad or good about either one. It's just about what you as a country, what the people in a country specialize in. And if the best use of our natural gas is exporting it, then we should export it. If the best use of our natural gas is to manufacture things here and export those things, we should do that. But I don't think that's up to government bureaucrats to determine. You know, we let the market determine how all other products get sold and get priced. I'm not sure that natural gas is a particularly unique situation.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Tom in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. Years ago, or maybe it's still existent, but there was something called the Kaiser Permanente Healthcare System out in out on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that is still in existence. And it seemed like that would be a good way to go for, of my understanding of it, which is very limited, that would be a good model to follow for some kind of a national health care system. And I'm just wondering if the guest had any thoughts on that.
Thank you, Tom.
I have lots of thoughts on that. I think Kaiser Permanente has done a terrific job. It's one of the premier integrated medical practices in the country. They have something like 10 million subscribers, and they consistently post outcomes way, way better than national averages. Now, the problem with using it as a model is that you can have all the pilot projects you want. You can have things that work somewhere and won't work elsewhere. This is what one of the problems with implementing national health care reform in the U.S. We have so many states that are so different from one another, different populations, different needs everywhere. So what works there in California, they also have system set up in D.C. may not work in Wisconsin. It may not work in Mississippi. And the idea of integrated care, I think everyone agrees, is generally a good thing. But how you actually do that through policy, how you encourage that, is difficult. You know, where we had this managed care HMO revolution, so to speak, in the 90s, mm-hmm. and that actually held down healthcare costs. As a share of GDP, healthcare costs held constant through the 90s. But people push back because they want choice. They don't like being told no. Now, what Kaiser Permanente is, it's an HMO. You're supposed to get all your care within their network. So, you know, it didn't work in the 90s. I'm not sure if that's the way forward now. It may or may not be, and insurers are experimenting with all sorts of different care arrangements. So who knows, maybe we will see something like Kaiser Permanente pop up in more places.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom, so much for your call. Scott in New Glarus, hi.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask you both, with all of the issues that are worth debating back and forth, do you really believe that people in this country would elect for president a person who doesn't believe in evolution and believes in something like the rapture, where a bunch of people are going to be magically lifted up into the sky? I think they're going to be naked when that occurs. You know, do you really think that, getting down to the real beliefs of people like Walker, people would elect someone like that for the presidency? I can't believe they would, but I'm wondering what you both think.
Yeah, Jenny.
I'm not a Christian. I'm familiar with some Christian beliefs. I'm Jewish, and there are some things I believe in Judaism that may come off as incredulous to atheists. There are some things that Muslims believe that come off as incredulous to Christians and Jews. And you know, I don't think it's fair to try to characterize someone's religious beliefs as disqualifying them from the presidency, unless those particular beliefs are, in the way of, so something along the lines of eugenics. But I don't think Scott Walker or any other candidate really believes that. If you don't believe in evolution, you don't believe in evolution. I don't think that disqualifies you from being president. If you believe in the rapture, you believe in the rapture. I also don't think that disqualifies you from being the president. That's not a requirement of the job. That being said, I don't think that America would elect someone who's not religious right now. We're still very much a religious country. That might change, you know, in the future. But that's about all I'll say on that topic.
That's about it on that. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. Joe on Facebook says that he thinks the ACA should be the UCA because it's not affordable for a lot of middle class above the poverty line in Wisconsin. He says, I was on it in 2014, and I made just a little too much to get a subsidy. The cheapest plan for my needs was $350 a month when Dean Care wanted to raise it to $400 a month in 2015. I got off it and went on a much weaker HMO through my employer.
You know, the thing is that the ACA does help people who make very, very little.
People who make a lot of money generally don't really need the ACA's help, but there is this group of people, and it's where we're realizing it's a bigger number of people than people may have thought originally, that either don't get very much in subsidies or that don't get any subsidies. And they are oftentimes being actively harmed by the ACA because the cost of insurance has, without a doubt, increased, and it's increased quite a bit. And a lot of these plans become unaffordable when you don't have subsidies, when you don't have some extra help paying for them. And that's a group of people that's going to have it rough if the ACA remains as it is, unchanged.
Let's go to Mark next in Plover. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess one of the problems that I have is, and it's basically about all the issues that you're talking about, is all too often we seem to lack the journalists today that are willing to ask politicians, you know, whether they're presidents, governors, or legislators, the tough questions. And I'll give you just a clear example. Last week I'm listening to, I think it was the end of the week program where you have a rather progressive person and a rather conservative person talking about the issues of the week. And the conservative guy said the University of Wisconsin has never done a good job of explaining why it deserves the kind of funding that it gets. And nobody during that program, you know, basically asked a tough question, because that, you know, the statement on itself is baloney. We all know, and we've heard of economic reports that talk about what university systems do for economies, and yet the question was never asked, and that leaves in the public ear, I think, you know, the fact that the idea that was a fact. And I think that journalists are the public's voice, and unless they ask those tough questions, the public really doesn't, you know, get the right it deserves, and that is the right to know what the truth is.
Thank you, Mark, for your call. Do you agree, Evgeny?
You know, I think we're definitely seeing journalists that ask the right questions. I think in terms of sheer information, there's probably more out there than there ever has been in the history of journalism. The problem is that you have lots of competing sources of information, and figuring out what is and what isn't accurate is the bigger problem now. So I'm not sure if having journalists, you know, ask more of the tough questions, so to speak, changes that necessarily. I think people have a bit of information overload now, and you can have different journalists ask different tough questions, and you can have different answers. The journalists could be coming from different political backgrounds. They might have their own agenda in some cases, and then you have more and more of that information out there. It's still not easy to sift through that. So I agree, tough questions are good, but I'm not sure that's necessarily the big problem that the public is facing now.
We have about 40 seconds, so let's get to the last caller. I'm sorry it's short, but Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to echo exactly what the other caller said, and I disagree with your guest. Tough questions are not being asked, and I particularly feel Wisconsin Public Radio is thin-skinned because they're not asking the tough questions of a candidate, and therefore we end up with mediocrity or worse government. So I disagree with your guess. Tough questions are what information needs to be based on, and we got way too much fluff. We got a lot of fluff, but we need good, tough questioners, and public radio, in my opinion, over the last 30 years, is really a softball organization over the past 10, and I would like to have them get a little bit more aggressive and not be so worried about offending the right or the left, and ask the good questions.
All right. Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. And just a reminder that you're involved in it, too. People can call in and ask the tough questions. Nobody else has that on the air, so that's something we love. But point well taken. And Evgeny, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Covered a lot of different issues. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You have Jenny Feeman, our guest, fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show and to KP for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll come back and talk about the fabulous Ebony show. It's really a fashion show that's at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Stay with us.